Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And good afternoon and welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. I am not Vicki, obviously. Vicki is traveling this week. And I'm Eric Ryder, of course, the engineer and producer for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And I'll be filling in today for Vicki on part of the show. The first portion of the show, Vicki will be talking to author Dr. Barbara King. And she's got a new book called Being with Animals. And she examines why we care so deeply about our furry, scaly, and most of all, irresistible friends in the animal world. And then coming up in the second portion of the show, I'll be talking to author Gordon Grice about his funny and fascinating book called Deadly Kingdom, where he makes it clear we are not necessarily on top of the food chain. And today he'll share with us some remarkable tales of life in the wild, from the menacing to the beautiful to the gory and downright disturbing. But it's definitely going to be an interesting and fun hour. So stay tuned here as we bring you our Wild Kingdom edition of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Now here's Vicki with an interview that she recorded recently with Dr. Barbara King.
My guest in this segment is Barbara J. King. She's a biological anthropologist and Chancellor Professor of Anthropology at the College of William and Mary. She's studied monkeys in Kenya and great apes in various captive settings. And she writes essays on anthropology-related themes for Bookslet.com and the Times Literary Supplement London. Her previous books include Evolving God and The Dynamic Dance. And her new book that we're going to talk about today is called Being with Animals. Why are we obsessed with the furry, scaly, feathered creatures who populate our world? Barbara J. King, welcome to the show today.
Thank you so much, Vicki.
Well, this was an interesting book, I have to say. You must have put a lot of effort into the research here. I'm wondering, let's just, first of all, share a little bit more about your background, and then we'll go into the book. And I'm interested to learn how long it took you to put that together. But share a little bit more about your background first, how you got into anthropology and what interests you about it.
Okay, sure. The truth of the matter is that as a college student, I was absolutely committed to the study of pre-med until I ran into organic chemistry and calculus. And at that point, I began to rethink, and I stumbled onto a class at Rutgers University in New Jersey about apes and human evolution, and something just expanded in my mind, in my heart, and I just felt so connected to learning about our past, to learning about how we became human and like other animals, but also different from them. So at that point, I just threw myself into anthropology, went to graduate school, and had the most amazing opportunity to work in Africa. I first lived in Gabon in Western Africa and studied captive chimpanzees, and then went on to Kenya to walk around after wild baboons and study their interactions with each other. Since then, my students and I have spent a lot of time studying communicational research with great apes, gorillas, bonobos, and chimpanzees. So all along, there's been a very strong thread in my anthropology of understanding how animals communicate with each other. And suddenly, it just struck me that I wanted to write more about us, about the human mind and how we connect to other animals and how long we've been doing that. One last thing I could add is that my husband and I do rescue feral cats. So we're surrounded at home by cats, you know, draped over every surface. And then I go to work and I work with apes, or now analyzing ape behavior on video. So animals have been a very big part of my personal life, too.
Right. Now, so where did you begin even researching this book? Because you cover everything in it. You go back centuries. You look at religious aspects of animals. You look at spirituality and animals. You look at our human connection today. And you even discuss how technology might affect these relationships. Where did you begin with this?
Well, in a sense, this work is a natural outflowing of some of my earlier books. I researched this one for about, I would say, 2 years, and tried to throw myself into the literature on archaeology, cultural anthropology, and also, as you mentioned, the works that touch on how we have invited animals into our spiritual lives, both in the present and the past. So it was a lot of reading, but it did sort of build coherently on what I'd been doing. So I found it really, really enjoyable and not terribly, terribly time-consuming.
I wanted to ask you this, Barbara, because Jeffrey Moussaf Masson, who is the author of When Elephants Weep and The Face on Your Plate, he put a blurb about your book, and he said, "Being with animals is a remarkable work, and the deconstruction of Man the Hunter alone is worth the price of the book." What did he mean by the deconstruction of Man the Hunter?
Well, first of all, I was very grateful for that comment because it meant a lot coming from such a wonderful writer. I think what he meant is that so often we tend to think of ourselves as having become human through hunting. If you turn on a TV documentary or you read a popular work in anthropology, Man the Hunter has been a staple. You know, we were all living in these relatively undistinguished groups, and then we got the bright idea to take spears and hunt down other animals, and it made us cooperate, it made our brains expand, and boom, we became human. And this just does not fit with the anthropological facts. I'm not the only one to recognize this, but what I wrote about was how for very many thousands and even millions of years, we were prey. We were the weak animals in the African ecosystem. So I believe that we evolved very much because we had to become, we were forced to become, keen observers of other animals. You know, animals eating us for lunch at the waterhole, the lions, the other big cats. And so natural selection and evolution put a premium on our paying attention to other animals. What interests me then is how that shifted over time and how we began to not only hunt, but to really think about other animals. And in other words, my argument basically comes down to this, that we evolved with animals in such an intimate way that they became so much more for us than even food. They became symbols to think with and religious parts of our lives. And all of these multi-layered sort of meanings are what form the theme of the book.
Yeah. You have a chapter called Raven, Shamans, and Dogs Who Dream. I wanted to talk about some of the aspects of this. You discuss how animals are central to shamanic practice and how animals may act as protective spirit guides during shamanic soul flights. Tell us a little bit about that.
I was very influenced by a book by the anthropologist Piers Vitebsky, and he has worked for some time in Siberia, where there is today still a very deep connection between certain people and reindeer. So this is a reindeer-based economy. But what fascinated me was that it goes so far beyond just resources, economy, and food. People there have a very emotional connection to reindeer. And in certain cases, the spiritual leaders of the group, the shamans, do take soul flight and relate to animals in a kind of very mystical way. People who are not shamans may also dream about reindeer and interpret their lives through what the reindeer do in their dreams. The thing that interested me a lot, and this was probably more in the past than right now, but it is possible for people living in this part of the world to have a reindeer actually choose to substitute themselves in death to save the person from dying. In other words, this is the belief in the community that there are lots of animals living around these people and living with these people, but it is only reindeer that may specifically choose to substitute themselves for a beloved person in death. So it did a couple of things for me. It cemented my idea that yes, there are animals that play very fascinating roles in our spiritual lives in a variety of expressions around the world. And it also showed me that, you know, we think of cats, dogs, birds in our lives here in the United States, but this plays out in fascinating and different ways with different animals in different parts of the world. So there's an underlying structure, but a different expression of this depth and this bond.
That's interesting. I did not know that about reindeer. That's interesting. I'd love reindeer. Who doesn't, right?
and you know what? The ethnography that I read would describe how it's possible to lock eyes with a reindeer and actually feel, you know, another creature there. Well, I've never done that with a reindeer, but I've done that, as I'm sure many of your listeners have, with a variety of animals. In my case, gorillas, certainly, you know, looking and seeing in those eyes, seeing a real presence looking back at me, a very soulful presence, someone who's in there, someone who's thinking, someone who's sentient and feels emotion. And that can be a very meaningful experience for people.
Yeah. You talk about dogs dreaming. You talk about the Runa people of the upper Amazon in Ecuador. They believe there's a significance in dogs dreaming. And it's funny because as I was putting together my notes for today's interview, my dog was laying at my feet and he was dreaming and he sounded quite distressed. So I actually woke him up. He sounded as though he was not enjoying the dream. Do they dream as we think of them dreaming?
I don't know the answer to that. I think we would all love to know what our animals are dreaming. I had my cat in here just a few minutes ago, and, you know, the little paws were moving in sleep and twitching, and the mouth was twitching. And everybody sort of jokingly says, oh, you know, they're dreaming about catching a bird or something.
Right. But,
you know, one of the challenges of what I do and what I write about is exactly this, that we want so badly to understand what's in an animal's mind, whether the animal's conscious or dreaming, but we can't exactly know that. This gets us into that whole arena of anthropomorphism, right? Ascribing thoughts and emotions to other animals. And I think we have to be really careful how we do that. While I like to describe all these patterns around the world and what people think, for example, the group that you mentioned in Central America, South America, suggests that when dogs dream, the people can interpret their dreams. But as a scientist, while I want to report these things, I also want to think very cautiously about them. You know, we can't know always what apes, dogs, reindeer are thinking. And the fact that we know that they're sentient and emotional creatures is very, very important. But we have to keep that separate from deciding, oh, they're dreaming about this or they're thinking about this. So here is where it becomes important for me to sort of assert some scientific caution, I guess, into the proceedings.
Right. And talking about the human-animal connection, there's a great story in the book about a whale in San Francisco. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you if you'd share that story with our listeners, Barbara. I'm talking with Barbara J. King. She's the author of Being with Animals. Why are we obsessed with the furry, scaly, feathered creatures who populate our world? Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Intuitive dream coach Joyce Chapman says there are no little dreams, that every desire is important, and that you deserve life to its fullest. As a dream activist, Joyce has helped thousands of people gain clarity about their lives and make positive changes. She can help you too. See more information at joycechapman.com. And if you have a question for Joyce regarding your dream, email joyce@joycechapman.com.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Body, mind, and spirit. Alternative Talk 1150 covers it all.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we're talking in this segment with Barbara J. King. She's the author of Being with Animals, Why Are We Obsessed with the Furry, Scaly, Feathered Creatures Who Populate Our World? And Barbara is a biological anthropologist. She studied monkeys in Kenya and great apes in various captive settings and wanted to take this a step further and include humans in the study. Right, Barbara? So I want to ask you if you would share, we're talking about the how we humanize animals. I wanted to ask you if you'd share the story of the whale who got trapped in San Francisco.
Yes, this is one of my favorite stories, and it happened several years ago. If we can just picture the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, which I think most of us can, in the waters right off of the bridge, a whale became tangled up in equipment that's used by crabbers. So you have to think of this enormous mammal. She's about 50 tons and 50 feet long, but she's seriously compromised because her blowhole is not able to stay above the water. She's being pulled down by these crab pot ropes that are very heavy because they have weights attached to them. Now, there were some boaters who noticed this distress of this whale, and they determined to try to rescue her. So a number of divers came off of their boats and got right into the water with the whale, and they were trying to cut the ropes and help her. This was very arduous work, and it took about an hour. Of course, we can imagine that the divers might have been a little bit nervous, a huge creature also feeling emotional distress. But they described later that she stayed very calm and she allowed them to work around her. Well, the most interesting part is what happened after. The rescue was a success and she was freed from the ropes. And the divers kind of backed off and expect that she would just bolt for the open sea, but she didn't. What she did is she circled her rescuers and went to them one by one, four of them, and nudged each of them in turn. And I read an interview with one of the divers in the water who said that it was an absolutely life-changing moment because this huge mammal was looking at him, and he felt that she was thanking him and his companions in the water. And in this case, you know, I thought that was an apt description. I didn't consider that some kind of incautious or inappropriate anthropomorphism, because here we have an animal who makes a very deliberate, conscious choice, who goes to each of four people in turn and gently nudges them. And this cannot be some sort of blundering or random accident. This is a thoughtful act. We may call it a thank you, and who knows if the whale has a concept of gratitude, but whatever she was doing, it was very meaningful. So this moment became transcendent for the people in the water, and then the whale went off and, you know, presumably is alive today. So I just love that story.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful story. And you know, I can definitely buy into that. Many years ago, I had a horse. I had him for about 8 or 9 years when I was in my teens. And he got run into some barbed wire by a pack of other horses and suffered severe cuts and almost died. And the thing was that I was a little bit terrified of him because I was a little bit terrified of him. Sometimes I was and sometimes I wasn't, but he was very unpredictable and I was rather green as a horse rider at that point. But when he got so ill, my dad had driven me up to the stable and I stayed with him in the stable at night and he rested his head on my lap. He was lying down on the floor. He could not stand at that point. And we really didn't know if he'd make it through the night. So he had his head on my lap and he just stared up at me the whole time. And from that point on, there was a whole different relationship between us. And I was not afraid of him anymore. And he seemed very protective of me. Now, whether I'm humanizing him too much, I don't know. But I believe our relationship changed at that point.
You know, that's a really great story. And to me, it does sound very much like a transformative moment. And I do believe that that's absolutely possible. I've had similar moments with cats who are very injured. You know, we care for this feral colony that is near us, a bunch of cats who live near a public boat landing. And because this has become known in the community, people will sometimes, unfortunately, discard, I don't know how they can do this, just cats that they know we'll take care of. And sometimes we have very badly injured cats that are left there. And I'm thinking of one in particular named Patrick, who was very badly injured and just left. And we had to do a lot of fairly invasive cleaning of him and dealing with his wounds. And even though we were gentle, it was difficult. And over time, he just seemed to come to trust us and to let us do these things. Mm. And he's bonded with us. And, you know, it just amazes me that even animals we don't know seem to have a sense when you're really trying to help them, when you're dealing with them in a loving and gentle manner. And I've spoken with wildlife rehabilitators who have told me the same thing about birds and squirrels. So I think that this goes to show that there is a real mutuality and a real attunement between humans and animals that can be kind of created together, as you did with your horse.
Yes, definitely, definitely. How do you think that technology might affect the importance of the human-animal connection? You touch on this in your book. Talk to us a little bit about that, if you would, Barbara.
Well, I think there's upsides and downsides. Interestingly, I have a blog that I write every Friday, and I ask people who are readers and listeners to send in animal stories. It's at www.barbarajking.com. And my last column, a recent column, was about how an elephant in a zoo in Australia is tweeting. This is an elephant who was a kind of miracle birth, an Asian elephant born to a mother who was supposedly not able to create a healthy child. It's kind of a long story. But in any case, this elephant was born, and the zoo was so excited that they actually not only, of course, gave the elephant a name and blogged about the elephant, but gave the elephant a Twitter account.
I read it.
I am new to Twitter.com. I do tweet occasionally, but suddenly this weekend I found myself not only writing about the elephant, but when he read my little blog, tweeting with him. And, you know, I have mixed feelings about this. I mean, do we need to put words into the mouth of an elephant to tweet? But on the other hand, the people that wrote back to me after my blog were saying that they began to think about elephants in a new way when they really got to know how playful this elephant was. And, you know, the tweets are based on his real behavior. They're not just totally, you know, made up. There's something about the Internet that allows us to appreciate animals. I do worry, though, when, you know, we get into this sort of cult of now cats are tweeting and elephants are tweeting. I found out this weekend there's a whole bunch of this stuff going on. I also worry because there's companies out there who are suggesting, as many of us have heard, that it's possible to take a pet who dies and send them into some technology company, and that company will clone the animal.
Mm-hmm.
I find that very distressing because, you know, you can't recreate an experience with a pet through genetics. As we've been talking about, the experience we have with animals is one based on spending time together, spending love together, and the attunement that we have with an animal will change both of our lives. So you just can't take, say, a cat who's, you know, passed on and take its genes and make a new one. It doesn't work that way. So there's so much that's promising about technology in our lives, but to the extent that it kind of reduces animals to either genes or to our thoughts about animals, that's when it starts to concern me a bit.
Right, and I read that the cloning company is in South Korea and it costs $150,000 to supposedly...
expensive. And, you know, the fine print says, well, gosh, we can't even guarantee that the coat color of your pet will be the same, much less the behavior. And I do think I'm very sympathetic to people who get kind of sucked into this because I think it can be so tragically difficult to lose a beloved pet. You know, I've certainly been through that. It's hard. You think back on the animal and you wish you could recreate those years. So I understand the impulse. I just think that the companies aren't being quite upfront with the small print in a way that I would like.
I think it's kind of spooky myself. Do you believe that animals have souls, Barbara?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that they have deep emotions, and they can, in some cases, do things that we don't understand. As a scientist, I always, you know, I'd love to be able to say, well, gosh, we figured out animal behavior. And in the case of, for example, the depth of intelligence of the great apes and their tool using and their strategizing for the future and their affection for each other, we've learned a tremendous amount in the last 30 years. But animals do things all the time that we can't understand. In Being with Animals, I write about elephants who recognize bones of their loved ones on the African plains, even as they walk right by and ignore bones of animals that were strangers to them in life. Now, you can only know this if you're there as a researcher and you know which sets of bones are which and you know who is kin to who. But long-term researchers in Kenya do know these things. So what does it mean when an elephant strokes, you know, really lovingly strokes the bones of an animal that was kin to that elephant in life? How do they know? Are they thinking soulfully? Are they thinking spiritually? We just simply have no real understanding of this. And this kind of work is in its infancy.
Yeah, I was interested to read in the book how you talked about chimps who carried their dead babies around for quite a considerable amount of time.
Oh, yes. And in fact, in the last couple of months, there's been new research that's, you know, too new for me to have written about, showing the depth of grief in specifically chimpanzees. There's two primatologists who wrote in the journal Current Biology, and in fact, if you go to a search engine and you type in Current Biology and chimpanzee death, you can come up with a little video that's very, very interesting. Some companions of a chimpanzee who died in captivity really tried to revive her and even held a little vigil around the body and very clearly mourned. And this is something that zoo curators across North America and into England and Europe have begun to recognize and are now allowing apes to basically file past and spend time with the dead body of another ape rather than just, you know, whisking the animal away as if nothing ever happened, to allow the animal to feel grief. So I can answer the question, are they feeling? Certainly, yes. You know, the soul question is probably a little beyond my capabilities as an anthropologist, but I do know that, for example, the former Pope, Pope John Paul II, did think that there was continuity between animal and human souls. And a lot of religious leaders have come out and said, yes, they don't see any issue in admitting that animals likely do have souls. And I think that's very, very interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting. Well, you set out on this journey to find out why we're obsessed with the furry, scaly, feathered creatures who populate our world, as you put it. What conclusions did you come up with? Why are we so obsessed with them?
Well, I think the answers come in two parts, and one we've already touched on, and that is our very long evolutionary history with other animals. We talked at the beginning of the conversation about how we were prey and we became hunters and we began to think symbolically with animals. And what I found is that judging from the very deliberate burials that our Neanderthal cousins carried out and the cave paintings that our early ancestors made, animals were just, you know, going alongside of us on our evolutionary journey. So it is really deeply ingrained in our nature, and I don't mean in any simplistic genetic way, but rather a very thoughtful and emotional way, to feel that we are most complete when we're around other animals. I mean, those ancient cave paintings are astonishing for the detail and the sort of glorious understanding of other animals. And we also begin to find temples around 11,000 years ago in Turkey that celebrate our spiritual connection with other animals. I mean, it's been with us all along. I have tons of examples in the book. The other part of it, though, relates to time in a different way, not evolutionary time, but our ability to enter into relationship with another animal and just lose our concerns, lose our modern-day stresses, our hustle and bustle and running around. I know that when I spend time with apes or my cats or when I'm visiting people's dogs or birds, there's a sense of our stress and worry falling away, and we enter into this almost timelessness with other animals. They certainly have concerns in their own life. What happens day to day to them matters greatly to them. But when we enter their world, and it can even be in a national park looking at buffalo or elk, it doesn't have to be in our homes, there's just a wonderful falling away of all the sort of minutiae and stress of our lives. And I think that's the other part of the answer.
Yeah, I would definitely concur with that, because I know myself there are times when I wanted to scream in the middle of a project, and instead I've got up and walked my dog for 10 minutes at dog park, and I'm laughing like a kid again.
That's great, Vicki, because that's so true. I have never had a day with my animals that, you know, I wasn't transported to some sort of joyful place.
Right.
I'm feeling sad, and they, for me, at least personally, animals do that in a way that some beautiful scene, you know, some wonderful mountain or wonderful lake that may make me feel serene, it's just not the same, because there's not that mutual attunement of a mind, you know, coming back at you.
Yeah. Well, is this fascinating work, Barbara? What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I just like to say that one thing I've discovered from doing interviews and book signings is how many of us animal people are out there. I've been absolutely moved by the number of people who rescue animals, help animals, work towards animal welfare. That may, you know, take many different forms. Some people won't eat meat, other people will. Some people just move turtles out of the road when they drive. Other people help with spay-neuter. I think it's a really great sea change that's coming where we work for animals as much as think about them. So I think that's a good note on which to end.
That's perfect. And your website is barbarajking.com, correct?
Yes, that's right.
And listeners can find out more about the book. You can also find a blog there that Barbara writes. And again, that's barbarajking.com. And her book is called Being with Animals. Why are we obsessed with the furry, scaly, feathered creatures who populate our world? Please do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
And coming up in the next segment, I'll be talking to author Gordon Grice, who's the author of Deadly Kingdom, the Book of Dangerous Animals. We may love animals, but they are, as we know, wild. And when we come into contact with them, sometimes bad things happen. We'll find out more about that right after these words. Stay tuned for more here on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And I am Eric Ryder, filling in for Vicky today. Stay tuned.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicky St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicky asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Feed your mind and your body and spirit will follow. Alternative Talk, 1150.
We're kind of living a wild life today here as we bring you the Wild Kingdom edition of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And Vicky is traveling, maybe out there even seeing some wild animals. I don't know for sure, but this is Eric Ryder, engineer and producer for the show, filling in for her, at least for this segment, where we're going to be talking to author Gordon Grice. Now, Gordon has written for The New Yorker, Harper's, Discover, Granta, and other magazines, and his first book, The Red Hourglass, was named one of the best books of the year by the Los Angeles Times and the New York Public Library. His work has been anthologized in the Best American Essays, and his new book, Deadly Kingdom, offers an unsentimental view of the natural order and our place in it. Here's some facts from the book that you may find interesting. Armadillos carry leprosy. 16-foot-long alligators exist, and many alligator victims were inebriated at the time of the attack. I think that goes without saying. But 30-pound diamondback rattlesnakes have killed more humans than any other snake in North America. You're more likely to be killed by a tiger in captivity than in its natural habitat. And here's one that's this one really I find interesting. In 1999, Canberra, Australia, recorded 254 magpie bird attacks. So something out of an Alfred Hitchcock movie or something there. But these facts and many more are available in the fascinating and, you know, sometimes very funny, but very dark sometimes, too. A great new book called Deadly Kingdom, written by our next guest, Gordon Grice. Gordon, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
So tell me a little bit about the book. We've talked, you know, just in the introduction about some of the facts and interesting fun facts, if you will, that are in the book. And I'm just kind of curious, what made you want to write a book like this? It's not quite an encyclopedia, but it's just full of a lot of facts about animals, but not necessarily like a whale is so many pounds or whatever, but more about how each animal can kill you. What got you fascinated in the ways that animals can attack?
What really prompted me to do it was that I wanted to read this book, and the reason that happened was that I had read the other books on this topic, and sort of the standard work was this one that Roger Karras wrote in the 1960s and then updated in the 70s called Dangerous to Man, and a wonderful book, and he tried to survey the entire animal kingdom with violence in mind, and it was terribly outdated, and that's not a knock on Karras. He did a great job, but the reason it was outdated was that we had learned so much about the natural world and our place in it in the interim. And so it seemed to me that we needed to know, you know, to have kind of a big perspective, you know, a survey of the entire kingdom, but to understand why aggression happens and why other dangerous encounters happen the way they do happen.
Yeah, it's interesting because you talk about the philosophy that has kind of changed in reporting various animal attacks. It used to be a lot of any kind of animal attack was considered just aggression from the animal world, but now our thinking has kind of shifted to where we kind of take the circumstances where these attacks provoked, you know, and it seems like most attacks were somewhat provoked by, you know, humans in one way or another, whether it be like, you know, taking away animal habitat or whether it be you describe kind of a grisly scene that happened. I think it was in the San Francisco Zoo where some people were taunting a tiger. And then the tiger busted loose, basically, and you know, basically attacked several people. So why do you think that shift in thinking has happened as far as how we think of animal attacks?
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. In the 60s and 70s and the earlier books that I mentioned, something like Tatiana the Tiger would have, that distinction would have registered with Roger Karras. In that case, three young men taunting a tiger, and the tiger retaliated.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to see there that that was a provoked attack, and that it doesn't necessarily tell you what a tiger would do in the wild.
Right.
But the other aspect that you mentioned is what I think we haven't really taken full account of yet, and that's the fact that habitat destruction and other large-scale actions of ours have a lot to do with how animals behave. So, for example, there's a theory that chimpanzee attacks on African children are more common now than they used to be. Now, that's hard to prove because, you know, it's not something that would necessarily have been counted in the past. But we've known about that since the 1950s, that chimpanzees sometimes would prey on human children. And it seems like there are more instances of that now. And it seems like the reason may be that their habitat has shrunk and that agricultural land has encroached on what used to be forest land. Mm-hmm. We're in closer proximity to those animals, and they are more stressed in terms of their attempts to find food.
Mm. And you talk about how it seems like many attacks actually happen when animals are in captivity as opposed to when they're in the wild. The ones that are recorded. And it seems pretty obvious why an animal might strike out in a situation like that.
Yeah, and that was one thing that that really surprised me as I began to research it. Back in the 60s, for example, there was a pilot whale named Bimbo,
mm-hmm.
And he was considered psychotic, and that was the exact word that was used. He was also diagnosed as what we would now call having bipolar disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this is a human psychiatrist diagnosing a non-human animal in our own terms. But the reason they felt that he was abnormal was that he kept attacking not only trainers, but also his pool mates, the smaller dolphins that shared his pool.
Mm-hmm.
And to the human observers at the time, it seemed incomprehensible why this animal would do this. We understand a little bit more now about how an animal that sees the world partly through echolocation, you put him in what's essentially a concrete box, he's going to be under stress all the time. It's as if you force some human being to live with a blindfold on. And this, to say nothing of the social structure that he should be living in, that was ruined for him.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in 40 years ago, that seemed like an animal that had something wrong with him. And now, with a little bit better understanding of animal behavior, we see that as an animal stressed by what we did to it.
Yeah. And, obviously, if a human was in a situation like that, they might very well strike out, as well and attack their handlers. So tell me a little bit about the process for the research for this book. In the introduction, you kind of talk a little bit about your childhood and how you got fascinated in this sort of thing. You go back and you find a lot of stories that are maybe kind of anecdotal, but you try and find the true facts behind them. Can you talk a little bit about the research process for the book?
Yeah, like a lot of your listeners, I'm sure I grew up fascinated with animals, but to me, one of the most interesting aspects was the aggressive ones, the ones that people were scared of, and that probably had to do with the childhood encounters with mountain lions and bobcats. But as I began to try to pull this book together as a research project, one starting point, of course, was scientific papers and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I was interested in looking at old books and what they had to say, because they had a lot to say about specific behaviors of animals. But what was just as interesting was the misunderstanding of animal behaviors and the changing views of those behaviors that we had through history.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example. There was a period in European colonization of Africa when the lion was considered vermin. So in other words, it was something to be exterminated like a rat.
Mm.
And at that period, the lion was not considered necessarily that dangerous an animal. Obviously, people were aware that it could kill you, but the idea that it preyed on human beings wasn't terribly important. The idea was that it was this undesirable animal that people wanted to systematically exterminate. And then, of course, we know that later on the lion acquired other meanings, the symbol of Britain and the king of the beasts and all that sort of thing. So these views that people had of the animals colored their perception of behavior. In other words, sometimes we got the facts wrong because of the prejudices that we brought to looking at the animal.
Hmm.
For a long time, for example, there was the idea of the rogue lion, and that was what you called a lion that ate people.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they chose to call it a rogue was because it was considered abnormal behavior for it to eat a human.
Yeah.
We now understand that that's not really abnormal behavior. It's not majority behavior in lions, but it's perfectly normal if, for example, cub lions learn it from their mothers, or if at a certain period in the juvenile life of a male lion, he encounters human beings at the time when he's ready to experiment with his diet. Those are perfectly normal behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
They're just behaviors that we would like the world not to engage in. But from the lion's point of view, there's nothing abnormal or pathological about them.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about lions that hunt humans as actually being compared to serial killers. As if, they're just, trying to just kill things rather than that's what they do because they're hunters,
Yeah, this is such a, I think, kind of a grotesque instance of us attributing human judgment to animals.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially what we're saying there is they're evil if they kill us. And, of course, that's just not the case. I mean, we have to look at it and understand it from the point of view of what they are seeing, what they perceive, mm-hmm. and that's impossible to do, I suppose. But it's but we can come along a lot further than we used to be able to in doing that. We can say, for example, that to another species, human life may not be such a high value.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that our thinking has shifted for the better when it comes to how we think about animals these days? I mean, it seems like animals are more under threat with their habitat than ever before, but it seems like at the same time, maybe our thinking has evolved in a more positive way. But I'm not sure. What's your take on that?
I do think that on balance, we have a much more positive attitude. I mean, if you consider that, say, 120 years ago, we really didn't have the idea of conservation, at least not in the, you know, in the days of Theodore Roosevelt, we had the idea of conservation as a way to preserve hunting opportunities. And now we have an understanding of, you know, not only the aesthetic value of animals to us, but also their intrinsic value to an ecosystem. And so, we absolutely have come a long way. Sometimes, though, there are negatives to that. In other words, when people don't fully understand what that worldview entails. The example that I think is relevant to us in North America is that we so desire to be a part of the natural landscape. Many of us, at least, so value the animals that sometimes we forget they don't necessarily feel the same way about us.
Right.
And
right.
You see people who want to be close to a cougar or a bear or something like that, and they get too close and they get hurt or they get killed. It's possible to take it, in too simplistic a fashion. But yeah, on balance, I think we've come a long way in understanding it.
Well, there does seem to be some thinking among some folks that as long as their intentions are pure, then the animals will somehow sense that and realize that we're their friends, and therefore, you know, they won't be harmed. I'm thinking like specifically of, did you see the movie Grizzly Man?
Yes.
That attitude that guy had was just like, you know, he's the friend of the bears, so the bears should know not to, you know, harm him. And of course, that ended very badly for him. But
And that's it's a terrible example of, or a great example, I guess, of anthropocentrism.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that, I mean, his compassion for those animals, I think, was genuine.
Mm-hmm.
But he then went the step further of assuming that they would think the way he thought.
Right.
And if we really love animals, we have to be willing to value them for themselves and still admit that they might hurt us.
Mm-hmm. And that's a very natural thing for them, actually.
Yes, for many of the animals. That's perfectly normal.
Well, we've got to take a quick break, but we'll come back with more with Gordon Grice, author of the book Deadly Kingdom, the Book of Dangerous Animals. Stay tuned. We're coming back here on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Eric Ryder filling in today. This is Alternative Talk 1150.
Draw? Some, but mostly lions and tigers and bears.
Lions?
And tigers?
And bears. Lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Yost, founder of The One Gathering. Join me at my Healing Happy Hour, July 9th, 7 to 9 p.m. at the High Spot Cafe. Take in appetizers, live music, tarot card readings, seated Reiki, and massage. Silent auction items as well. Cash bar provided and only $15 at the door. Proceeds go to The One Gathering in October. See you at my Healing Happy Hour, July 9th, 7 to 9 p.m. at the High Spot Cafe. For more details, visit theonegathering.com.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick & Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 11:50.
Thanks for joining us on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. If you have comments or questions on any of our shows, we want to hear from you. Email info@conversationslive.net. Call Vicky toll-free at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or leave a message at our special listener voicemail box, 206-414-6159. That's 206-414-6159.
On the AM band at 1150 and on the FM HD band at 98.9 HD3. Alternative Talk 1150.
And that, of course, a clip from The Wizard of Oz. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my. And we are kind of talking about lions and tigers and bears by way of the book Deadly Kingdom, the book of dangerous animals by our guest today, author Gordon Grice. And it is a fascinating book that I have been enjoying quite a bit. And Gordon, during the break, I was telling you last night, I was reading the section about the deadly cats. And you even go in there and talk about some of the things that house cats do that are a little bit unnerving. And my house cat was sitting next to me and kind of rubbing up against me in the book as I was reading. It was kind of a funny juxtaposition, I guess.
I think there's a... You know, there's a continuity between the domestic animals we live with and mm-hmm. the wild animals that we kind of see as completely different things, but they're so similar. Tigers are so similar to house cats.
Yeah, you talk about also how, you know, you were never bored growing up with your cat because, you know, he was a true hunter, I guess, and that he would hunt pretty much anything, you know, a ball or a string or, you know, a snake even.
Right, and, you know, insects and so forth.
Yeah.
A domestic cat is just a great way to get to observe nature, and some people, of course, are horrified when their cat brings them a dead bird or something.
Right.
A tribute. And to me, that's just a fascinating. I don't necessarily want my cat to bring that in the house, but it's just such a fascinating behavior.
Well, what's interesting to me is you talk about how there's a surprising amount of lions being kept as pets in America. And I wonder if it's, you know, our love of our house cats or our dogs and the fact that, you know, they can be trained to, they don't harm us really. I mean, even if they go a little over the line, it's just a nip or something on our just the fact that we love them so much and they seem to reciprocate that. Is that why people think that therefore, like, you know, a lion could be taught to, be, you know, your best friend like your dog or something like that?
I think that's a big part of it. I also think there's a certain psychology for some owners that it's like people who like to have a big, tough dog because it's sort of this, it's like a sort of machismo to have a dangerous pet. And you do see some of that among people that own the dangerous exotic animals.
Yeah, there was one, I think you said there was a mountain lion that was being held in like a junkyard instead of a dog.
Yeah, it was a watchdog for this junkyard, and pretty effective as I understand it.
I would imagine, but, you know, what about the guys that have to go and work there?
How would you like to open up that yard in the morning?
Exactly. Well, the book is Deadly Kingdom, and I want to, before we run out of time here in about 2 minutes, I want to mention that your website is deadlykingdom.com, and that folks can find the book pretty much anywhere books are sold, your Amazons, your Barnes & Nobles, et cetera. So people should definitely check it out. Deadlykingdom.com, of course, the website. What was the favorite thing that you uncovered, the favorite fact that maybe you didn't know as you were doing the research for this book?
I have to say, in looking at the primates, David Zadera sort of jokes about always wanting to own a pet monkey, and I think this is, you know, a fantasy that a lot of us had growing up, that you would have a friendly chimpanzee in your house or something. But the statistic that amazed me that came out in, you know, when Travis the chimpanzee launched that horrible mutilating attack on a woman was that the number of pet primates who eventually inflict some sort of violence on a human being is about 100%. These are the animals that we seem to understand the best. They're the most like us. They have similar body language to us. And ultimately, probably because of that misconception of ours that we totally understand them. They're some of the most dangerous.
Yeah. Well, we hear about helper monkeys, you know, so it just seems like they, and as you say, they're so similar to us, it seems like they should be able to be, you know, domesticated, but at their core, they're really wild animals.
Yeah, they're their own beings. There was an interesting case in the news not too long ago of a helper monkey that was owned by a man who suffered from PTSD from, war trauma. And was a great helper monkey, I believe, for several years. But at some point, it attacked the man and injured him badly, and then there was another attack, and they had to be separated. The monkey had to be taken out of that role. And it seemed as if some of that came just from one incident of the man accidentally stepping on the monkey's tail.
Wow.
This is one of the sort of unappealing ways that they can be like us. Maybe they hold grudges. Hard for us to understand.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating book. Some of it is a little dark, obviously. I mean, when you're dealing with, you know, the people, the idea of people getting eaten, that's got to be dark. But it does have a good sense of humor to it, I think, and it is a fascinating book. Gordon, we're out of time, but again, the website is wildkingdom.com, and I hope deadlykingdom.com. Sorry about that. Deadlykingdom.com. Gordon Grice was our guest. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Eric.
And we'll be back next week with another edition of Conversations Live. Stay tuned to Alternative Talk 1150, and thanks for listening.